Welcome to IMTV. I'm Alan Keyes, and this is Let's Talk America. Now, for most of the time this week, we've been talking about the attack that President Trump ordered against the chief terrorist involved in the Iranian government, the reaction of people to that attack, but also some of the issues that are involved when the president takes these sorts of actions. We'll be concentrating that on that in the opening of a segment of the program today, with a particular emphasis on the congressional reaction. You know, Nancy Pelosi taking great umbrage that the president didn't brief them, and so forth and so on. Other things coming out to suggest that when they were approached for a briefing, they weren't exactly interested, which makes you wonder what's really on their minds. And we'll be talking about that and the difficulties that are now posed by the very partisan environment that Nancy Pelosi and others like her have created with respect to the Trump administration and how it hurts the country. We'll do all that with a very, very special guest today who will help us understand it all right after these messages. Second week of November, I was privileged to participate in the Red Pill Conference in Mesquite, Nevada. It was sponsored by G.W. Griffin's group, and it brought together a whole array of activists and conservatives thinking through how we can wake people up to what's really going on in this country. There was a whole series of presentations that addressed political issues, issues of health, and other things that are being done to take away our understanding of what's really being done to transform this country into a totalitarian tyranny. If you understand the danger, then you'll want to be watching these DVDs. We're going to put them together in a series. I'll be introducing the different parts of the series, and they'll all be available at imtv.us, the exclusive distributors of this series of views of the Red Pill Conference. Welcome back. Now today, as always, when I am able to have him on, I'm very pleased to share with you the wisdom, the knowledge, the information of somebody who I think is a real national treasure, because the work that he has done has shared a font of information of the sort that we really need, information about our country, about the godly foundations of the nation. He's done so in books and especially in something that brings him to my mind quite frequently during the course of every week, which is his American Minute, in which he shares at the anecdotal level, the level of the story of lives and actions and activities of the people who were involved in our history, and gives you the kind of insight that is very, very special. And he has become, as a result, I think, almost a walking encyclopedia of such insights, and he brings them to bear with uncanny accuracy on the events of our time. And that's Bill Federer. Welcome, Bill.
Among other things,
Bill has been a candidate in our politics and so forth, but I think you have been especially important to us all as a great educator of the American people in their true heritage, so much neglected these days. But welcome to the show. Really appreciate it. What are you doing these days now? What's your priority?
Just writing and speaking. I did another new book called Miracles in American History, Volume 2. And I basically trace religious revivals throughout the history, even as far back as Pierre Marquette evangelizing the Indians. He founded Chicago, the settlement there, and he had 500 Indian chiefs and about 1,500 people, and he presented the gospel to them. And then the First Great Awakening with George Whitefield, and the Second Great Awakening with John Wesley and the circuit riding preachers, Francis Asbury. And then the first black preachers in America. Richard Allen founded the AME, African Methodist Episcopal Church. And then you had John Stewart. He was a black man who was in Ohio, was a dyer of clothes, you know, like blue jeans. He was robbed of his life savings and was going to commit suicide. And right before jumping in a river, he heard somebody call his name. So he stopped, but he went to the nearest town and was going to drink himself to death. And one time he was wandering through the woods, heard singing. And it was a camp meeting revival. He goes to it. The Lord touches his heart. And long and short, somehow the Lord impressed upon him to walk northwest. And he just started walking across hill and stream, wading across creeks, runs into the Wyandot Indian tribe. They had never been evangelized before. Anyway, he starts, they're going to do their Indian dance. He sings in his deep bass voice, these Negro spirituals. And when he's done, they say, more. And so he sings some more. Eventually, the whole tribe became Christian. And when the Indian Removal Act was pushed through by a Democrat Congress, the entire tribe moved to the Missouri River, and they named their city Wyandotte City. A few years later, they named it Kansas City. Mm-hmm. So Kansas City, Missouri is still in Wyandotte County, and it was founded by these Christian Indians who were evangelized by this black man, John Stewart. Just fascinating stories, but it's all packed in this book. It's called Miracles in American History, Volume 2.
How can folks get their hands on it? What's the best way?
Well, it's AmericanMinute.com is my website.
Good. So go to AmericanMinute.com. Don't do it right this minute because we have wonderful minutes coming up for you, but do it. I do it frequently because I find that one of the things I most enjoy, it's like a little bit of relief when I get a chance to visit with the folks in our history at the hands of somebody who is as knowledgeable, accurate, and caring, who really puts the emphasis and the priorities where it belongs. So I recommend everything that I have found Bill doing and that he has shared with us, it's important and worthwhile. And it helps you, as we'll find on this program, to think through some of the details of what we're dealing with. And one of the ones I'd like to start out with today, Bill, is this question of whether or not Nancy Pelosi and others, including, by the way, I saw today a couple of people who are on the Republican side. Let's put this up on the screen here so folks can share the thought. Mike Lee, and it also says in the article that I saw at the Washington Examiner, Mike Lee and Rand Paul, I think it were, a Republican senator blamed a dismissive attitude toward Congress for fueling his outburst after a classified briefing on Iran's missile attacks on Iraqi bases that host U.S. troops. He said he had found the briefing insulting and demeaning because of how the Trump administration officials refused to answer questions about needing Congress to authorize the use of military force. And we've actually come to the point now, Bill, where you have a lot of folks in Congress, including Nancy Pelosi and others, who make the assumption that somehow or another, the President of the United States cannot use his position as Commander-in-Chief. And cannot deploy the armed forces of the United States except he waits on permission from the Congress of the United States. And I find that kind of surprising, to tell you the truth. And I find it surprising because it flies in the face of the wisdom of our founders, who knew very well, as they put it. They started out saying this in Federalist, I think, 64, talking about the need when you're negotiating treaties, right? It seldom happens in the negotiation of treaties of whatever nature, but that perfect secrecy and immediate dispatch are sometimes requisite. And that juxtaposition of secrecy and dispatch, which meant immediate, quick, timely action, action suited to really pounce on the opportunity, that becomes essential. Well, later, in the same context, they, of course, emphasize the fact that you also have to have secrecy and dispatch when you're dealing with issues that have to do with the national security of the United States, right? And so the question arose as to whether or not the president needs to consult. And it was made very clear that even though, by including advice and consent, he can negotiate treaties and take other actions, he can do so in secrecy, because other nations often require that, and with the requisite initiative, meaning being able to act in a timely way when that action is going to be to the best advantage of the United States, without having to consult the Congress, they put in the advice and consent on treaties precisely so that the result would not go into action without the participation of the Senate. You see what I mean? But they wanted the president to be free. And a similar remark is made with respect to what is required when you're dealing with military matters. And the fact that you have to be able to act in the field, in the cabinet as in the field. There are times when you have to act immediately, because if you don't, the opportunity for effective action to the best interests and security of the country will disappear. And that means you don't have time to ask anybody questions. The responsibility of the executive is to act. It seems to me that Mike Lee, Nancy Pelosi, all these people are completely forgetting that, even though the situation of Soleimani exactly illustrates what the founders meant. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, yes. President Obama took out 3,000 people with hits, it's estimated, and he did not consult Congress on any of those. He didn't just take out a general. He took out the leader of a country, Gaddafi, the head of Libya, without asking Congress's permission. And of course, its Congress was quiet about that. And so the fact that they're bringing it up now, it does have a hint of just the continuation of the political bias against the president. But it is understood that during times of crises, as you mentioned, decisions have to be made quickly. This was something that the Roman Republic understood. So Rome was a republic for about 500 years. They had 600 senators, and they would meet and discuss things. But when an attack happened, they had a position that they actually created that was titled dictator, but it was a one-year term. And Cincinnati, Ohio, is named after him. He was a farmer, and yet he was known for being courageous and good at making decisions. And so when the Roman Republic was attacked, they got Cincinnati to come off his farm, and he was the quote-unquote leader, dictator of Rome. He won the victory. Afterwards, he goes back to farming. And then he's around 80 years old, and Rome is attacked again. They go get him. They bring him in. He is the dictator, and he is in charge, 100% control for a year. He wins again, goes back to his farm. And so this model of using this power concentrated in times of military crises, but then not coveting power and letting it go back to the former government, clearly the delineation between peacetime and wartime. But this is where you got the Order of Cincinnati. A whole lot of the founding fathers after the revolution joined this order. And then, of course, Cincinnati, Ohio is named after this Roman general. But it was this understood concept that in a time of war, you have to have someone in a position to be able to make decisions. Now, the previous administration, I don't agree with a lot of the decisions that were made, especially with deals with Iran. But it was up to the people in America to vote out that administration and vote in someone that they did agree with, which I believe is the case right now. But George Washington, he was the first president. There was a military threat. It was the Whiskey Rebellion, and a guy in Western Pennsylvania had actually got together a militia army and was attacking. And Washington got on his horse and he led the army. He didn't ask Congress's permission. He led the army to Western Pennsylvania. Of course, when he got there, the rebellion had dissipated. He arrested the people organizing it, and he forgave them, and it went away, which set a very good precedent for the country. Madison did a similar thing during the War of 1812, helping to command the troops, although not as specifically as the general in the field. But again, Madison didn't ask Congress's approval.
Well, I think that that is literally what corresponds to the understanding that the founders have. And I think it's important to go through their reasoning a little bit more in detail, because this was something that they emphasized repeatedly, and Hamilton does so in the Federalist Papers. Let me read a little bit of this. They who have turned their attention to the affairs of men must have perceived that there are tides in them, tides very irregular in their duration, strength, and direction, and seldom found to run twice exactly in the same manner or direction. And he goes on to say that to discern and to profit by these tides in national affairs is the business of those who preside over them. And they who have had much experience on this head inform us that there are frequently occasions when days, nay, even when hours, are precious. The loss of a battle, the death of a prince, the removal of a minister, or other circumstances intervening to change the present posture of affairs may turn the most favorable tide into a course opposite to our wishes. As in the field, he says, so in the cabinet, there are moments to be seized as they pass, and they who preside in either should be left in capacity to improve them. So often and so essentially have we heretofore suffered from the want of secrecy and dispatch that the Constitution would have been inexcusably defective. Hear that, inexcusably defective, if no attention had been paid to these objects. But they did pay attention, and they essentially left the commander-in-chief free to take the initiative based on time and circumstance, the nature of the threats facing the country and so forth, without having to wait. Imagine two things, that President Trump had to wait and interview all these folks in the Congress, particularly right now, Nancy Pelosi and her fellows in the House, who have been showing the symptoms of a kind of insanity, to be quite frank about it, for the last little while, a partisan insanity. Given that partisan insanity, so bent on destroying the Trump presidency that they have disregarded truth, disregarded legal and lawful procedures when they were preparing the articles of impeachment, and are now disregarding what is required by the Constitution, which is to send the articles of impeachment to the Senate. And Nancy Pelosi is arbitrarily sitting on them as if she does not have now to carry out the will of the House. She's acting like she's some kind of dictator over the procedures of the House of Representatives, when once the majority has spoken in this matter, she's just an agent and factor of the people's will, and she's not doing it, as expressed by that body. And we can agree or disagree with the conclusion they came to, but she doesn't get to just sit like some Politburo member and dictate to people who are essentially her minions, whether or not their will was actually serious or just a joke. She's treating it right now as if it's just an instrument of her partisan, even personal ambition. Now tell me, if you're Donald Trump and you're dealing with people like this, who include, by the way, people who have openly sided with our enemy in the Middle East, openly derided and detracted from the seriousness of their taking of human life, Americans killed by terrorist organizations and attacks, people like Ilhan Omar and others. If you are looking at that, I have one question, Bill. Given what the founders thought was the priority, do you think it would have been prudent or even safe for President Trump to have revealed his plans to people like that in the Congress?
Right. So you bring up a very important point. And although Mike Lee is tremendous, I applaud the great stands he's been taking. The question is, if the president had to reveal the information to him, he would also have to reveal it to those Democrats. And as you mentioned, many of them favor the enemy in this instance through their tweets, through their statements. They're making it clear that they would rather side with the enemy. And so here you're going to give a briefing to someone who has admitted that their hatred toward the president is so great they would be willing to leak information to the enemy. Now, one of the stories that is interesting to look at when we talk about taking out military leaders is Yamamoto. So he was the Japanese admiral that orchestrated the attack on Pearl Harbor. It was a brilliantly executed attack by our enemy. He did say that at the beginning of the war that Japanese had the advantage and would have win upon win, but if the war drug on, the Japanese would lose. Anyway, after the loss of Midway, the Americans had cracked the code that the Japanese were using. And Yamamoto was sent out as a high military official to go to the areas of the front line to assess the situation. And when the Americans read the coded messages and they actually saw, they had determined exactly where he was going to be, at what date, and even at what time. And it was 9:35 in the morning on April 18th, 1943. Now, the Americans were far away, and about 400 miles. And the only planes they had that could reach that far were a P-38G Lockheed. And so 18 of them take off, and they have to fly 400 miles below 50 feet in altitude to stay under the radar. And it was dead reckoning. In other words, they couldn't be sending out radio signals to figure out where they're at, or they would be alerting the enemy. And so you had Chester Nimitz, the supreme commander, or, you know, the head commander there, giving the order. You had Bull Halsey, the other admiral, and he sends out the order. They didn't ask Congress for permission to take out the military leader of Japan. They just did it. And lo and behold, the Americans were circling at about, you know, 4,000 feet, and the Japanese were flying in of about 1,500 feet. And when we spotted them, our guys just dove in and killed them and crashed their planes and so forth. And so they were treated as American heroes for doing a hit. Wasn't drones, it was planes, bombers and fighter planes. But again, this was the top military leader in Japan was taken out without consulting Congress.
Now, of course, the one thing that people will raise, and I know that this has been a concern with Rand Paul, and it's one, by the way, that I share. So what I'm about to say reflects a sense that I have of what we ought to be doing in Congress. Because even though I don't believe we should be acting as if the president has an obligation to violate his judgment about what secrecy and immediate action are required in any given circumstance, I do believe that we need to take seriously Congress's responsibility to be involved in the declaration of formal warfare, right? And all of the things that follow from it. And so we're faced with the question these days, and have been really since 73 when they passed the War Powers Act, and we're concerned about whether or not we were going to be endlessly involved in wars that never ended, and Trump campaigned on this, that were never, by the way, declared. So I'd ask a question. It's just by way of introducing a discussion. We won't have time to finish it in this segment, but we can get back to it because it leads to other questions. And that question is, in the absence of a declaration of war, what should be the approach that is taken by responsible people in the Congress and responsible people in the executive branch to the fact that the power to declare war was reserved to Congress because they were afraid of leaders who, for the sake of their own ambition, would abuse military power in order to involve the Republic in kind of endless wars that then militate to the transformation of the regime from a republic that's representative to a military dictatorship, basically, which is what is really established in various ways in times of war. We only have a minute left in this segment, so I'm going to give you time to ponder that and then answer it when we get back. Is that all right, Bill? We'll be
back
right after these words to get into this discussion, which I think gets into an area where we need to put aside all of the passions of our day and see if we can get a clear view of the balance that needs to be struck. We'll be right back. Hi, I'm Alan Keyes. I just want to let you know that on a recurring basis every Tuesday, we're going to have a guest, Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. He's going to be joining us to talk about the whole array of challenges, both in terms of our health as a people and as individuals, and our health as a nation. We'll be looking at those things through the eyes of someone who has thought deeply about many things and who has many great ideas to share with me and with you and with everyone who tunes in to Let's Talk America on Tuesdays, when we meet with the Health Ranger to talk about how we sustain the health of our liberty. Thanks for staying with us. When we left, I had just introduced the question of what should we do? Because after all, there is a danger that was recognized by the founders, which then led them to give Congress a role in making sure that there would be, when appropriate, formal declarations of war, so that the people would have to be apprised before we were committed to long-term efforts like World War I or World War II. That would involve us in military conflicts. And that would then be governed, by the way, by a different sense of priorities, because war always imposes a certain discipline that has to be respected. And the one who enforces that discipline in our system, whether some people like it or not, is the president, because he's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces and has to make sure that they are effectively disciplined, trained, and equipped so that they can get out there and provided for. Get out there and win the wars. But it does raise a question, doesn't it, Bill? And what do you think is the kind of balance, and what procedures would serve that balance to make sure that Congress remains a representative at the end of the day of the fact that war or no war, we are still a representative government in which the people ultimately have to be consulted when we are involved in long-term endeavors?
Well, again, you bring up a very important point, and the government in the three branches was designed to be a tug of war. It was designed so that each branch would jealously defend their jurisdiction against the other two branches. Use the illustration of being a kid, and we came in from playing. There's one brownie left in the pan. My mom has an idea. One of you cuts it. The other gets to pick the first piece. Well, the one cutting it doesn't know which piece he's going to get, so he wants to cut them exactly equal. But if you can imagine a big brownie, three hungry boys, you give them each a job. The first one is to trace out on the brownie where it's going to be cut. He doesn't know which piece he's going to get, so he tries to trace it equal. Second one's job is to take the knife and actually execute it and cut it. He doesn't know which piece he's going to wind up with, tries to cut them equal. Third one's job is to judge and see who gets which piece. So you have their greedy, hungry tummies causing them to be honest. Anyway, so the idea is that the legislative branch lays out the laws, the executive branch signs it and executes it into law, and the judicial branch judges the law. And their greedy, hungry tummies cause them to be honest. It's a stroke of genius. It would be like a Sunday school teacher giving an assignment. Design a system of government where sinners keep other sinners from sinning. So there's no angels on earth to govern us. All we have is selfish men. Well, let's pit the selfishness in each branch against the other two. So it is designed for there to be a tug of war. And so as we're observing this tug of war taking place, that's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
And so I agree that we don't want the president to get too much power, but we don't want the Congress to get too much power, and we certainly don't want the judges to usurp the power of lawmaking and so forth. We see this showing itself several times. Jefferson, we all loved him because he did the Louisiana Purchase, double the size of the United States, 828,000 square miles. But did you know that he sort of did it first and then ask the Senate to rubber stamp it later? Yes. The treaties were supposed to be made with the Senate being involved, but it was such a good real estate deal that Jefferson more or less did it, and it was just thrown to the Congress to rubber stamp it. So you could have said that he, you know, was pushing the envelope. And then you look again with the case with Andrew Jackson, first Democrat president. Gold is discovered in Georgia, 1829. A bunch of people are taking land from the Indians, the Cherokee. You have some Christian missionaries having cases to defend the Cherokee. It goes to the Supreme Court, and Justice John Marshall decides in favor of the Cherokee that these Georgia citizens didn't have the right to take their land. Well, it comes up to the president, Andrew Jackson, to enforce it. And the famous line was, mm-hmm. Andrew Jackson said, Marshall made his decision, let him enforce it, which was tongue in cheek, because obviously the Supreme Court justice does not have an army at his disposal. So in other words, yeah, the Supreme Court made its decision, but I, as the executive branch, are just going to thumb my nose at it and not carry it out. And so we see this tug of war between the branches has been going on for quite a while. And the fact that it's going on now is in a sense healthy, because again, you have to deal with the personalities in each era. And right now we have an era where those that are in charge of Congress have a significant amount of people that could be considered traitors, to put it in a pretty blunt way.
Well, that is a blunt way, but I think it's the way you have to put it. A little bit of that hint, I think, was in a couple of people, including the president, who reminded folks that not only suffered an attack from these drones, wasn't a very effective attack in response to the attack on Soleimani, but we suffered a drone attack, but we also suffer from the fact that we probably provided them with the money to have those drones when Obama was in the business of buying them off with large amounts of American cash, some of it delivered in secrecy, by the way, on pallets, that they just took the money over in cash. That was pretty dramatic, but it does raise questions, doesn't it, in your mind, about whose side these folks are on. But in your analogy, which I think is very apt, the thought that occurred to me was that one of the most sophisticated aspects of the American Constitution is that in order to have that tug of war, everybody has to have their hands on a piece of rope that will affect the other parties, pulling them in this direction or that, the way you do in a tug of war, right? You have to be connected up. And that gives you a way of influencing their situation and moving them in this direction or that direction. That's why we ended up with a separation of powers, but also with, in interesting instances, a moment there where a branch will have a power not strictly its own. The president's veto power is a good example, because he gets involved in the legislative process on account of that veto. The power over the purse is probably the Congress's most important power when it comes to constraining executive action, because you can't move if you don't have the money to sustain it. Now, on the other hand, if we think about things the way Theodore Roosevelt did, you have to realize that there's another side to that business of budgeting, which initiative has an important role in. So he had put together the Great White Navy, as it was called, because all the ships were painted white, and he sent them off. He sent them halfway around the world in order to demonstrate America's a kind of participation in what was, in fact, an ongoing kind of naval competition in those days. And when they got over there, people said, well, how are we going to get them back? Say, we don't have enough money in the budget. And his response was Navy's over there. It's up to the Congress to get them back. And so he illustrated that his initiative can actually has a way of checking and balancing the Congress's power of the purse, because he's in charge of making sure that our armed forces are where they need to be, when they need to be there, in the best interest of the United States. That puts a burden of proof on the Congress in terms of its support for the rational interests of the country. And finally, you have the interesting question of the Supreme Court. And I think this is the fascinating one, Bill, because I'm constantly, when I think of the Supreme Court, put in mind, and your illustration just did it for me. Hamilton says, in I think it's Federalist 78 when he's talking about the court, it's in the context of judicial review, I think, and he boldly says that the Supreme Court has neither force nor will. That's interesting, isn't it? See, the Supreme Court doesn't command the forces. You just pointed that out. They can have an opinion, they can make this decision, but they don't have the forces to carry it out. The president does. And so if the president doesn't agree with them, things are liable not to happen. And presidents, several of them, actually took account of this, and the Supreme Court said stuff, and they said, no, that's wrong, it's not constitutional, and I'm not going to do it. So what happens then? Well, here's the rub, and it gets us, I think, directly to our present situation. There is one branch of government that if there is sufficient political will, meaning to say if the feeling of the people is sufficiently strong that it affects the judgment of people from the states and from the districts in both houses of Congress, then you could find a majority in the Congress that could take advantage of the fact that Congress can, when it has sufficient political will, majority in the House, two-thirds in the Senate for the president, that the Congress can remove any official, including the president and the vice president and the justices of the Supreme Court, from their position. So ultimately, though they are branches sharing powers and equal in terms of their control of those powers, one of the branches has a power that, if the people will it sufficiently, can actually clean house in the other branches. And that puts us in the situation, I think, in which we find ourselves. Because the tussle can be decisively affected by the participation of the people in the elections and how they are informed or manipulated as they go into that critical moment when the body of the people actually appears in its effective role as the sovereign who determines the composition of the government personnel. Isn't that the situation we're in? And won't this whole year we're getting into be affected by that reality?
Well, I think this year is going to definitely be affected by it. One of the things I thought was interesting was the number of people in Congress that were getting money from the Iran lobby. So you say, okay, Congress, yes, but you have congressmen that are in office because they need money for their elections, and they get money from all kinds of different sources. And lo and behold, some of them are getting money from an Iran lobby. So Iran, interesting history. You mentioned Teddy Roosevelt and the Navy. Winston Churchill transitioned the British Navy from coal to oil. Unfortunately, there was only one oil well in all of England, actually located in the Sherwood Forest. So Britain now needs oil. And so in 1859, oil is discovered in Pennsylvania, then Oklahoma, and then Baghdad, and then in Iran. So in 1908, the British form the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. In 1950, they changed the name of it to British Petroleum, or BP. And so you had World War One, with the Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany wanting to get oil from Baghdad and Iraq, and the British wanting to get oil from Iran. So we begin to see that the Middle East was pulled into these oil war competitions. But after World War II, you had Mossadegh was the leader of Iran, and he was democratically elected, but he nationalized the oil industry. In other words, he took away all the oil company from Britain. And Mossadegh was leaning toward friendship with the Soviet Union. Britain appeals to the United States. Eisenhower approves the first CIA operation, it's called Operation Ajax, to overthrow a foreign leader. So our CIA go into Iran, and we find people that we can agitate and organize, and we cause all kinds of crisis. And sure enough, we overthrow Mossadegh and we install the Shah, who loved America and he was supportive of America. He wanted to secularize the country and was a great friend until he was betrayed by Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, felt like Russia was the big threat. And so it's better that Iran fall into the hands of the fundamentalist Ayatollah, and it'll be a thorn in the Soviet Union side. So Jimmy Carter and Zbigniew Brzezinski are sort of responsible for putting the Shah in power that created this anti-American sentiment in the first place. But the people of Iran actually are not in favor of the Ayatollah, and they they don't even speak Arabic. They speak Farsi, yet the Ayatollah is so fundamental that he demands that that Quran only be in Arabic. And so you have a population of people that are obviously dissatisfied. And even just a month or so ago, demonstrations where thousands were killed by the government. Mm. And so we need to understand, in a sense, that the big picture is what I sense is there are forces that want to pull America into a war in the Middle East. Remember John Kerry saying, oh, I just want a little war, you know? And I think that my feeling is Trump is showing restraint in not jumping into a war. And I think that's an admirable quality. But so in addition to the branches of government in America, we have to think that maybe there are some congressmen that are being influenced by foreign powers, and that needs to be added into our analysis of the situation.
I think that's very astute, and I think it's going to have a particularly important role because of the fact that those forces who basically want to take over our foreign policy, which right now requires a judicious combination of clear, convicted resolution when it comes to defending ourselves and not being intimidated in any way by threats and by attacks and other things which the Iranians have been offering in abundance. So I like the stance that Trump has taken in the combination, the Soleimani episode, as well as other things that he has done, show that he's somebody who understands we have the force and will use it if we are compelled to do so by the aggressive activities of those who are seeking to destroy us or the folks we have to work with, the allies that we have. And I think he showed a lot of restraint because a lot of people wanted him to react instantly in some big way after the Saudis suffered the attack from Iran. And he was patient and actually ends up doing something more dramatic than would have been some immediate response that involved bombing oil fields or doing whatever. But also, if you think it through, given the importance of, in this case, of the commander, command, control, communications, the three C's of the essence of management in warfare, he took out a commander who was vital to both morale and strategy in terms of the Iranian position. And I think he has sent a signal that we both know how to be necessarily forceful, but we will do so in a strategic way. And in this particular case, didn't involve us in more war. It simply protected the forces we have already committed on the ground, and we'll see what happens. But it also had behind it, I thought, Bill, a sense that he wasn't afraid, if necessary, to commit us to battle. But if and when he does so, I think it's not going to be this kind of Vietnam-style incremental thing. It's going to be a strategic move that will mobilize the forces necessary to achieve the objective, which is to remove the thorn in our side that has been represented by the Ayatollah's regime. And I'll bet they're working hard to make sure that we are ready to do so, so that we won't get involved in a prolonged war. We'll just win a short one, as we did against Saddam Hussein. But we'll see. This raises a question, though, which I will then put back to you, because since they don't have control of the executive branch, I think there are forces trying one way or the other, whether it's influenced by foreign powers or by their own partisan ambition. They're trying to use the courts to inhibit the execution of this strategy that requires judicious use and judicious restraint when it comes to our power, but that also requires secrecy and dispatch, which the Congress seems incapable of now, to be quite frank about it, and untrustworthy. And that's why the founders did not subject the president to what could become a factional partisan mess in the Congress. And that's what the Democrats have, in fact, created. So if they turn to the courts, the question then becomes, what power does the court have in all of this? What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think the president's doing a great job replacing some of the liberal judges that have been in there, because it is going to come down to that's the lasting legacy. I wanted to pick up on one thing before I get into the court, and that's perception. And that foreign policy is perception. You said Teddy Roosevelt sent his Navy around the world. Why? He wanted the perception of America's strength to be out there. And so Trump is utilizing that. Sun Tzu's Art of War, you know, around 600 BC, he wrote it. And he says the best military commander is the one that has an army but never has to use it. In other words, you just exude strength and fear that they don't even bother to attack you, and you get your enemy to surrender without even having to fight them. But it's perception. You know, in Hollywood, they hire agents who want to, you know, mold their image, that they, you know, will have a perception of being a certain type of actor. Perception is so important. But when it comes down to foreign policy, it's 100%. And you know that because you were in the United Nations as ambassador for Ronald Reagan. And Reagan exuded strength, and that kept peace around all the interests that America had.
Well, no, I think it's very true. I often think of it in terms of our military power is like the sentences that are used to fortify the perception the world has of us. And our use of military power are the punctuation marks that divide those sentences in ways and give them the appearance that's needed to awe, to capture the minds of people who are looking at us and make it clear that this power is not just in perception, it's real. And that's what I think he did with Soleimani. That's a punctuation mark that then enlivens the sense that this is not just a matter of perception, it's a real force. And a will is behind it that will use it in judicious ways to make sure that America's interests are served and that the American people are safe. And I think that Trump has so far, both in the way he dealt with North Korea and the way he is dealing with Iran, I think he's made that combination. He's not only putting the sentences out there to remind people that we do have a large and effective power, probably the greatest in the history of the world, but that we also have the will, in a judicious way, to use it so they can't count on the fact that it's just a matter of what they perceive. No, it's a matter of what they'll experience to their detriment if they continue in ways that force our hand in terms of military action. But you could circumvent all of that if you accept the notion that the Supreme Court gets to tell Donald Trump or any president when he can use our armed forces. Because that would mean that instead of having the Congress, you have nine people, not even elected, who can then decide what could be the national security fate of our country. I don't think the founders set it up that way. In fact, I think they deprived the court of the ultimate say. And the other day, I read an article by Alan Dershowitz in which he was suggesting that in disputes between the House and or the Senate or the Congress in general and the president, the Supreme Court is the arbiter. But as some of the anecdotes you were talking about, I think, illustrate, but also as the Constitution itself says clearly, there's no vestment of power in the Supreme Court to decide disputes between the branches in this way. It can decide laws that may involve both branches in terms of wording of laws that Congress has produced and activities that pursuant to the law that the executive undertakes. But as commander-in-chief, the president also has, among other things, a power to tell people to do what goes beyond the law if it's going to save the country from extinction. And he can look them in the eye and say, and I will pardon you because this does formally violate a law, but we have to do it if we are to survive. And they set it up purposely so that when people look at our panoply of power, they need to understand that nothing is excluded from use, not by the Constitution. And if we let the courts pretend that they can arbitrate between the branches, I think that's going to deeply endanger the future of our country. Does that make sense?
Well, it really does. And when you see how the terrorists from certain Muslim countries were coming into America, and maybe still are, and the president said we're going to limit the immigration from those countries and have a court say, no, president, you can't do that. Or the president says, well, we need to build this wall, and a court says, no, you we're going to tie up the funding so you can't do that. Or the president says for military readiness and unit cohesion, we're not going to be a social experiment of transgenderism in the military. And to have the court say, well, no, you can't. We need to realize that the president has the responsibility as commander in chief to defend the country, not the courts. And so you bring up a very important point that the buck has to stop, as Truman said, with the president.
Well, you know, this whole question raises some issues that we won't have time to get into on this show because we're coming to the end of our time. But I think over the course of the next year, you and I will probably have a lot of occasions to get together. We've laid some groundwork for folks who followed the program, and I think produced something that will allow people to start thinking this through in terms of not just the words of the Constitution, but the actual strategic wisdom that was involved in the fashioning of those words and provisions. And Bill, I hope that you'll be willing to join me again fairly soon. Actually, to continue this discussion, because I think we're going to see further developments in this over the course of the next few weeks, and it would really be, I think, fascinating for us to get together and chat about it, and very informative to my audience. So I hope you'll come back and join me, because we still have a lot to talk about.
I'd be honored.
Thank you for joining me today. And as always, I hope y'all will look for the American Minute and sign up so that it comes into your mailbox all the time the way it does into mine. And you'll find that as you accrue the kind of wisdom and knowledge of our history and events and personalities in our history that Bill shares, these kinds of issues will come alive for you in a way that's actually informed by the heritage, the practice, but also the fundamental premises and thoughtfulness that characterized previous generations in American life. So I hope that you have benefited from this discussion. And as always, it's not enough to listen. I hope you'll be thinking about what you heard, ponder it, and then join us again here at Let's Talk America.